Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes David Sparling, the Chair of Agricultural Innovation and Regulation at the Richard Ivey School of Business. He's going to talk to us about past and present trends in food prices, and we're going to peer into the crystal ball for future trends and their impact on people with limited or fixed incomes. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Chef.
It was that you were quoted in the Globe and Mail that got my attention, Dave. Particularly your quote that people better get used to high food prices because they're going up and they're going to stay up. But I gather they haven't come up much yet in Canada.
No, Canada's world prices are going up, but Canada's been sheltered by a couple things. One is, you know, we're a large food exporter, and we're a major producer of food. So we aren't running short of food. We have lots available. And that shelters us to some extent. And the other thing is that over the last few years, the dollar has been rising pretty rapidly.
Yep.
And we buy a lot of our imported food from the United States. And so that has also sheltered us a lot. And so World Prices, the Food and Agricultural Organization in Rome, says that world prices were up 37%. This last month.
No wonder they have riots in different parts of the world.
Well, exactly. And whereas in Canada, the food price index has only gone up 2.1% from February 2010 to February 2011. So we really haven't seen the kind of increases that a lot of places in the world have seen. And actually, I don't anticipate that we will see anything like that.
Oh, good. Okay. I remember we took a walloping for wheat prices back there about a year and a half or 2 years back, but that's well behind us now.
Well, it's actually not that well behind us. 2008, grain prices shot up, and it was a bunch of things that were going on at that time. And they backed off in 2009, but they've been coming back up over the last year. So wheat prices have moved up quite a bit. Corn, soybeans, all of those things have moved up. Hasn't translated all the way through the food system yet for us, but
so there's more coming.
We're going to see some of those price increases.
Yeah, okay. A good part of this, well, a recognizable chunk of this apparently is due to feed for fuel. Ethanol from corn and growing use of other crops for ethanol. I read a story in the Globe over the weekend, I think it was a Friday story, on cassava being used in China. Big sales for corn. And it driving up meat prices because it's also used in animal feed.
Yeah.
Bizarre effects.
The whole food versus fuel debate has been going on for a while. And basically, the argument is that that we're using edible parts of corn, in particular, that could be used to be fed to animals or put into other, kind of processed foods, are actually mostly into animals, but are actually being used to produce ethanol.
Right.
And so a lot of people are saying, well, that's the reason why food prices are going up. And actually, that's one piece of the whole thing, but really, if you look ahead, you say, okay, what's driving food prices now, but what's likely to drive them in the future? We have a bunch of things going on.
Okay.
First of all, we have a population that's going to go, projected to go up to about 9 billion people by the middle of the century. So
world
we're going to have
population.
A whole lot more people.
World population?
Part the world population.
Yeah.
So that's going to be one big factor. But the other thing that's happening, which is actually making it, you know, that's about a 30% increase or so. The other thing that's really driving it is that people in developing countries, particularly China and India, are becoming richer.
Mm-hmm.
And when they become richer, they change their consumption patterns, and they actually start to consume more meat, more dairy, basically more products from animals. And to produce that meat or dairy products, you actually have to feed grains. And so you end up actually with a whole lot more demand. I think the FAO projects about 70% more total production needed by the middle of the century just to keep up with what they anticipate demand is going to look like. So there's, you know, there are people who, the growing population, they're becoming wealthier, they're eating more meat, and that's putting a whole lot of pressure. Then you have the whole feed versus fuel. So we're producing ethanol out of corn, and that's putting some pressure. I anticipate, though, that one will back off certainly by the next decade, because I think what we're doing right now is using the edible part of the crop, but what's going to happen in the future is we're going to move to what we call cellulosic ethanol, where
okay.
you use the rest of the plant to actually produce biofuels. And so you don't end up in a food versus fuel, you end up with a food and fuel combination. And so we'll see a lot more of that in the future. So that'll probably take off some of that pressure.
Oh, good. Okay. You raised the three things: was the population growth,
yep.
the change in eating habits, and the recent growth in use of edible portions of the food crop for ethanol, which you feel will change to non-edible portions of the food crop. Which of these is going to First of all, which of these is the least predictable? And then, which of these do you feel is likely to have the biggest influence going on from here? Now, you felt there wasn't a big influence going to happen in Canada, but maybe big influence elsewhere in the world.
Well, I think what we're going to see in Canada is probably a more gradual rise. But I do think we are going to see a rise in food prices just because of all of these factors. So let's go back to your last question, which is, which of these do I think is least predictable?
Yeah.
Population's pretty predictable. Lots of so that one's probably pretty sure. The rate at which people change as they become wealthier is actually quite predictable too. So
okay.
I'm not super uncomfortable with the projections on what's going to happen in terms of overall food consumption because of the changing diets. I mean, if the world economy, every time the world economy slows down, then people have less money, and so their diets change less quickly. But those diets are likely to change. The food versus fuel one is probably the least predictable of all of them, because we haven't got the science locked down in terms of cellulosic ethanol. So
okay.
That's going to take a bit more time, and there's just a little more uncertainty around that one.
So it's a question of an eventual leveling off of that influence.
Yep.
The big question is when.
Well,
be answered.
That's true. But the other thing that's uncertain is, because that's just one side, that's the demand side. There's
all
also
right.
the whole supply side. So we have an industry that recognizes, like, we're going to have to feed a whole lot more people, we're going to have to produce a lot more. And so there's a lot of science going into, well, what can we do to make the world more productive? In some places, it's as simple as, in Africa, for example, as simple as getting a decent food production system and a decent food distribution system, which is not a simple thing to do, of course, in Africa, otherwise it would have happened.
Yeah.
That place is a very challenging environment.
Transportation-wise, I can imagine.
Oh, yeah, and infrastructure and systems of trade, so they actually waste a fair amount just because they can't move it around well, so it's a tough one to crack. But you know, in other major producing parts of the world, a lot of our genetics and a lot of our soil sciences and things like that are going into and fertilizers are going to figure out how can we get more, first of all, more production, but also more predictable production.
So sustainable,
things
too.
That are drought resistant, so yeah. that you don't lose them all every time there's a drought in an area.
Yeah.
So you know, how fast we can actually ramp up our production system is another uncertainty.
Is this in the hands of huge agribusiness multinationals like Monsanto and so forth? Or is this more in the nature of government commitment to infrastructure and the scientific community's devotion to this development?
That's a good question, because there's one part of it is that is predominantly in the hands of the big multinationals, Monsanto, Syngenta, DuPont, a lot of those companies are all in that, and they're really working hard at their biotech, and some parts of the world hate it, but, you know, personally, I think we need everything that we can do, and some of it will be normal breeding, and some of it will be genomics, and some of it will be biotechnology.
All right.
So those companies will do the major crops. Universities and some of the government labs, I think that we have a responsibility in the developed nations to devote some of our science to, you know, really helping with crops that are important to developing nations, particularly
right.
places like Africa.
Okay.
And I think we need to devote more of our research capabilities to sort of the smaller crops and the ones that don't seem as important from an economic perspective, but are extremely important from a food security perspective.
It's true. Their diets are different, isn't it? Their
diets are very different.
Customs, yeah.
And their crops are different, and their environments are different, and so we need to really help them.
I hate to say it, but we need that variety, too. I mean, that's part of our
yep.
Resistant cushion, that even if we provide resistance to diseases and droughts and whatnot with our own crops, there's so much of monoculture that if something goes wrong, we need an alternative.
Keeping a strong, wide genetic base, I think, is important for the future.
Very good.
Because you just don't know what's going to happen, and so you don't want to lose all your traditional crops.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that happens is we're finding more and more about the relationship between food and health, and some crops have, you know, ingredients that are really important that we haven't quite figured out all of them yet.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So, example?
Well, I mean, if you look, we've seen lots in terms of, let's say, talk about the crops around here. It doesn't really matter whether you talk about honey from bees or a lot of the berry crops. We're seeing people do things with omega-3 in eggs and milk and meat.
That's true.
So there's a whole lot that we're starting to understand about the relationship between food and health. But actually, if you look, a lot of our research in that area is still pretty tentative. You know, it's early. We understand that omega-3 is really good. We understand that, you know, trans fats are really bad. So those sorts of things and salt. But a lot of the ingredients, specifics, and the interaction between ingredients, we don't understand completely.
Mm.
And I think you're going to see over the future, you're going to see more and more crops that are designed to have more and more ingredients, not just to, you know,
yeah.
we used to focus strictly on productivity,
yeah.
but now we're going to start to see people say, okay, well, we want to be really productive, but we also want it to have higher levels of, you know, lycopene, like in tomatoes, or vitamin D and mushrooms, things like that.
Very good.
Lots of cool stuff there.
Yeah. If your income's gone up by 1%, like mine, while food's gone through the roof, let's take pause in Mary's Kitchen by Tennessee Pusher.
Can't blame a thief for stealing wallets, that's just what they do. Can't blame Mary for stealing hearts when you taste a barbecue. She got a brisket nice and tender, best you ever tried. Well, she cooks so nice and slow, leave you satisfied. Kansas City to Memphis town, Arkansas on down. Come on in to Mary's Kitchen. action if you want your sausage ground. She got a sign on her front porch saying, hot stuff for sale. In a little three-room shotgun in the alley behind the jail. Sweet, sour, thick, or thin, tangy, hot, or mild. Some like it hot, some like it cold, some like it anyway, so Kansas City to Memphis town, Arkansas on down. Come on into Mary's kitchen if you want your sausage grind. Ribs. When it comes to what you want, the whole neighborhood's got dibs. One taste and you'll be hooked, it's like nothing else you know. Find yourself on the kitchen floor, hoping she throws you a bone. Kansas City to Memphis town, Arkansas on down. Come on into Mary's kitchen if you want your sausage grind.
You've been listening to David Sparling, the Chair of Agricultural Innovation and Regulation at the University of Western Ontario. He's been talking to us about the history and the future of food prices and how it looks for people with limited incomes.
In Canada, not a big effect unless we don't get the ethanol equation under control. Same in the States? Because they grow a lot of corn,
don't they? See, in Canada, we're not the same as the States in terms of the amount of ethanol and biofuels that we produce. So
okay.
I don't think we're particularly as influenced there. In Canada, it's really about what does the rest of the world's demand look like, and if the global demand really takes off and global prices take off, because we're an exporting nation, our prices will go up too.
Okay.
And that will eventually trickle down to certainly all of our consumers. So it's not so much about ethanol, it's really about what happens with
global
prices.
So the States is facing a different equation in relation to corn and ethanol and food prices than we are.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're, being exporters, we're pretty well insulated from fluctuations in demand because the demand just comes back to us as paychecks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it comes back to us as paychecks, but it also comes back to us as ultimately will come back to Canadians as higher prices too.
Yeah.
If there are higher world prices for food, then our domestic prices will gradually go up too.
Yeah.
So, but we are, well, Canada's an unbelievably fortunate nation in terms of resources. We have lots of food, we have lots of energy, we have lots of space. We have lots of opportunity,
so
we are very lucky. But as you know, you're well aware, not everybody is in that ideal position.
Well, that's true, and that brings us to the second part of the question, I guess, is what are the mechanisms that can be utilized for people who aren't going to benefit from this rise in the prices of agri commodities, and still have to meet the prices.
That's right,
in the market.
And so ultimately, those people are going to be probably squeezed to some extent. And so I was thinking about, well, what would I do if I was in, what would my choices be if I was in that position? And really, you come down to sort of two categories of choices. One is there any way that you can increase your income? So
yep.
is there a way to pick up some extra cash from someplace? Are there some new skills you can get through government programs? So that's one piece, and there's stuff that can happen there. Mm-hmm. The other is if prices are going to go up, and it's not just food, it's energy and everything like that, mm-hmm. Then what kind of pressure can you and people like, you know, in that same position apply on governments? And so if you mm-hmm. want to increase things like social assistance, you need to get politically active. Yeah. I believe everybody in Canada should be politically active, because then we get what Canadians really need. But
yeah.
If you're in that situation, I would, you know, strongly recommend get engaged in that. At least vote.
So at least vote. Very good.
At least vote. So there's the one, you know, what can you do on the income side? Then the other is, you know, if you can't do anything about the income, then basically you have to do better with the money that you have. And some of the things that any nutritionist would tell you would be pretty much standard for anybody on a budget. You know, if you cook at home and are careful about your shopping, you can probably find very good, low-cost but nutritious recipes.
Well, the growth of community kitchens and local gardens probably will play an increasing role, too.
Yeah, absolutely. You just moved. Because one of the things you want to do, you can also do, is lever, you know, your own resources with other people. So community kitchens are really good. And even if it's not even a community kitchen, even if it's just some people who get together once in a while to cook, because especially if you're by yourself,
yep.
cooking a good, nutritious meal sometimes can seem boring, and you don't have that incentive. But if every once in a while you got together with somebody else who was the sort of same and, you know, pooled resources, first of all, it's not that expensive. You know, you may be able to cut some costs, but you certainly can cut the drudgery and
yeah.
of that. So the community gardens is a new one that's becoming much more sort of important, and there's more of that happening. And I think that's a very good way to at least supplement your sort of food in part of the year. And it's not just individuals who are doing that. I know a lot of the food banks are getting into that, and they're looking mm-hmm. at ways to connect with farmers.
That's true.
To help, you know, pick up any waste in the fields. Often what will happen, there are some groups that will go in with volunteer pickers, and they'll go into a farmer's field after the field has been harvested, and they'll pick up all the rest. There's always good food left over, and they'll
yeah.
pick up all that and take it with them.
Yeah.
And that's becoming more and more...
Gleaning. Is the gleaning is
gleaning,
the historical
yeah.
name for
and
it. Yeah.
You know, and that really is. And farmers love that, because they generally hate to see their food go to waste, especially when somebody really needs it.
Yeah.
And we're seeing lots of support by farm groups for food banks and for different ways. We're also seeing farmers looking at different ways to get their products into the cities. Markets are a good source of nutritious food, and often you can get a decent price on the food, and it's a good way for farmers to get, you know, good value for their product by taking it directly to the consumer. So if you
probably not a bad price if you show up near closing time too.
Yes, everything's negotiable. That's true.
That's right.
That's true. Nobody wants to lug up, you know, load the carrots back into the truck. So
for sure. Okay.
I was actually at a meeting on last Friday, which was the presidents of a lot of the Ontario agricultural industry boards, and the representative from the Ontario Food Banks was there talking about, okay, here's what we're doing already, and how can we do more with you? And the farm leaders were very receptive.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think we'll see more and more of that in the future, because it's just... It's a good way for farmers to give back to communities, and often they can sort of manage it as just a part of their whole business. So
yeah, okay. I had another experience recently. Well, I had one 5 or 6 years ago, and I had a different experience recently to contrast the change in these initiatives. 5 or 6 years ago, I went to a local organization that ran community kitchens, and I expressed a wish to get into alternative diets and foods and customs through the community kitchen. They didn't like this, because this meant I was probably going to be working mostly with women. And they said, why don't you join our men's food group, you know? And the implication is we'll teach you how to how to heat soup in the can and make bologna sandwiches sort of thing like a real guy. And, you know, and then you can leave
that
our...
That hurts.
then you can leave our women alone sort of attitude. And at the time, there wasn't much in the place in the way of legislation. I just let the whole thing go. I wasn't interested. But in our neighborhood now has emerged, and that's Sherman and Main, pretty much in the east end of Hamilton, but not far from downtown. There's emerged an organization around St. Peter's Hospital who's shown a commitment to assisting newcomers, given that the federal support for newcomers, despite the rhetoric in the election, seems to be dropping.
Yep.
And in Hamilton especially, we had a big organization called CISO, Settlement and Integration Services Organization, get rapidly unfunded by the federal government. And St. Peter's Hospital has decided to step in and conduct community kitchens with the new immigrants in mind. And I said, holy, you know, wow.
Oh, that'll be...
Wow, can I join that? Because, you know, don't kid yourself. We're not going to be teaching them how to make Jell-O pudding, you know.
No kidding.
Yeah.
No kidding. That'll be fascinating.
As soon as the Hamilton-born and Canadian-born attendees at the kitchens get a load of the stuff that's on offer from places we've never seen or been, a lot of the information is going to flow the other way.
Well, and that's one of the really interesting food trends that's happening in Canada, too. I mean, just the recognition of how important our immigrant population is and our ethnic population is, and it's growing, and it's bringing all kinds of great food ideas, but it's also bringing demand for new food products that farmers in Canada haven't particularly been used to growing in the past, but they're actually starting to try and figure out, okay, how can we make the type of eggplant that, you know, East Indians like versus the type of eggplant that Chinese people tend to like, and so and they are different.
Okay,
and also every population has its own sort of different tastes and preferences. So there's, I think that's going to be a really interesting change in Canadian agriculture, and it's one that they're starting to figure out, but they have a lot to learn.
A blunter illustration of how this works at a hot meal kitchen, where most of the staff are volunteers. He calls himself DB, I guess because his name is probably too difficult for Canadians to pronounce. So I don't think he was a volunteer, but most of the staff are volunteers. And I saw him in the kitchen. I said, hey, D, when are we going to get our tandoori chicken? I'm just joking with him, you know. And he goes, actually, I've been thinking about that. He says, not too far in the future.
Good.
There's this vision of people in T-shirts and running shoes and toques, you know, sitting down to a free meal at a hot meal kitchen and getting used to something like tandoori chicken. The forces moving things in this direction are almost unstoppable.
Well, they are unstoppable, and that's not a bad thing at all.
No,
Having access to things like tandoori chicken is awfully, we're lucky. We certainly never saw that quite a few years ago.
Yeah, well, I just use that because I'm fond of it, but it strikes me it's an example of the riches of other cultures that are available, and the odd ways in which they will become available to people who haven't even asked for them, but are made aware of them and grow to include them in their arsenal of tools for coping with rising food prices and declining nutrition as their budgets get pinched. And they can resort to different kinds of diets to meet nutritional needs that no longer seem to be a serious focus of the kind of fixed incomes that are delivered to these people.
Well, they certainly don't have any excess cash to be able to get very extravagant with their diets at all.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that, too, I think is really important for people is to read labels and make sure they understand exactly what they're getting when they're investing those relatively scarce resources.
That's true. Is your lunch 1,600 milligrams of sodium? Or, you know, is it... you know, B and C vitamins and proteins and fiber and stuff like that. Yeah.
Fiber's been one of the interesting ones that, you know, it's always been around, but I think there's some recent studies that have just shown absolutely how important it is.
Blood pressure, I'm aware of.
Well, actually, there was a study just that said people who ate above, I think it was 30 milligrams a day, lived longer. I can't remember if it's milligrams or grams. Probably it's grams almost for sure.
30 grams
lived
of fiber,
longer,
yeah.
Than people who didn't.
Right.
And they, you know, basically took out a whole lot of other variables and said, well, it looks like it has a pretty significant health impact.
Yeah, for sure. One of the things you said also before we wrap up struck me as worthwhile consideration for someone on a limited income, and that's that a lot of these propositions for coping with rising food prices and a fixed income are not mutually exclusive, in that in the near term, it may be easier to access ways to increase your income. In the middle term, it may be easier to access possible changes to your diet. And then in the long term, there are other strategies you can use to mitigate the damage that this otherwise would do.
Well, certainly they're not mutually exclusive at all. You want to be looking at, you know, not just looking at your food budget and everything else, but, you know, what does your entire budget for your life look like, and where are the things that you might be able to cut back a little bit on if food starts to get more expensive, to make sure that you always have a nutritious diet. I mean, that's extremely important. But also, you raise a good point that really this isn't just about coping by yourself. It's really about trying to get into a community that helps you cope and helps you share resources. So I think that's an important piece for people.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate your recognition of that and sharing that with the listener. Was there anything else that you wanted to say about this squeeze that low-income people seem to find themselves in that most Canadians fortunately won't be facing in the future?
Not really. I just hope that that squeeze doesn't get too tough for people, both on the social assistance side and on, I hope food prices don't go up too quickly. You know, really a long gradual increase we can probably cope with. People get some time to adjust, and I don't think we're going to be seeing any rapid spikes, but what I do think we are going to have to prepare for higher prices in the long term.
Yeah, okay. Well, again, I appreciate you sharing that with us. I know that people on fixed incomes are varying degrees of half the poverty line right now, so I don't think there's a lot of elasticity in the
budget. No, I don't either.
For food. But there's a lot of techniques and resources and sharing that can be done in the meantime until we get a more responsive government of whatever of whatever stripe. And, you know, frankly, more money to play with foreign energy companies don't have their eye on or a claim on, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, appreciate your time.
Well, my pleasure.
All right. Thanks again. And we'll call you again if something dramatic happens in the area of food.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
Nice talking to you. Bye.
You've been listening to David Sparling, the Chair of Agricultural Innovation and Regulation at the University of Western Ontario. He's been talking to us about the history and the future of food prices and how it looks for people with limited incomes. Now for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These aren't the articles that we read to you. These are abbreviations of the articles from the newspapers that we name on the broadcast. Troubled campus station off the air. CKLN was early voice of Canadian hip-hop. Ryerson University-based CKLN 88.1 FM was shut down as of 6:45 p.m. Friday, after a long battle with regulators and years of infighting between volunteer hosts and the board of directors. In January, the CRTC announced it would shut down CKLN based on numerous breaches of regulatory and license conditions. It began an investigation in 2009 following complaints about governance, operations, and management. The radio station fought back, seeking to argue its case before the Federal Court of Appeal, but lost that bid Friday. The station will convene its members and volunteers this previous Monday to vote on a way forward, said station manager Jackie Tweenstra Harrison. Far from its celebrated origins as a groundbreaking lefty station, the first in the country to routinely offer then alternative programming of black music and gay celebrations, CKLN has of late devolved into a hornet's nest of confusion characterized by mismanagement and plagued by lawsuits.
At its mid-90s apex, CKLN boasted nearly 150,000 weekly listeners. But these days, fewer than 7,000 signed an online petition to keep it on the air. It lost many listeners during a seven-month 2009 lockout of CKLN operators by the Ryerson University building manager. The station fell short of many key CRTC requirements, such as musical diversity and local spoken word programming. It was criticized for inadequate programming during the lockout, 3 years of unfiled returns, lack of quality control, and inability to address complaints and commission inquiries. Station management is urging listeners and volunteers to donate and sign an online petition to show support for CKLN's survival. That story by Cynthia Vuquetz and Ashanti Infantry, staff reporters at the Toronto Star. Ontario electricity prices drop below zero. As spring temperatures rise, power prices plunge, but that doesn't mean homeowners get a break. There were 11 hours a week ago when electricity prices on Ontario's wholesale market were less than zero. A week ago Monday, prices dipped below zero for 5 hours during the night, going as low as minus 12.2 cents a kilowatt hour. On Sunday, power prices were also negative for 5 hours, dipping to minus 12.8 cents a kilowatt hour at the lowest. The price fell to minus 2.2 cents a kilowatt hour for an hour on Saturday. In all, the province's electricity system paid $1.377 million this past weekend, a week ago, to dispose of the surplus power. The negative electricity prices do not mean householders will get a refund or a credit on their next bill. But larger business users that consume more than 250,000 kilowatt hours a year and are charged the market rate for electricity can receive a credit for the power they use when prices are below zero. So if some customers are being paid to take Ontario's power, who's paying them? Ultimately, all customers bear the cost of giving away surplus power or paying others to take it. That may seem unfair to consumers who can't benefit from the giveaway power, but still underwrite the cost. Energy Minister Brad Duguid said, most of the time, Ontario is selling at a profit. When you put it all together, consumers made $1.5 billion since 2006 from our exports. That included some days in which Ontario's neighbors had to dump surplus power, and the Ontario system was paid to take it. Consumers are sheltered from spikes by regulated prices or fixed-price contracts. And that by John Spears, business reporter for the Toronto Star. Pitting fuel against food. An ever larger proportion of the world's crops, cassava and corn, sugar and palm oil, is being diverted for biofuels. With food prices rising sharply, many experts are calling on countries to scale back their headlong rush into green fuel development, arguing that the combination of ambitious biofuel targets and mediocre harvests of some crucial crops is contributing to high prices, hunger, and political instability. Soaring food prices have caused riots or contributed to political turmoil in a host of poor countries in recent months, including Algeria, Egypt, and Bangladesh, where palm oil, a common biofuel ingredient, provides crucial nutrition to a desperately poor populace. Biofuels development in wealthier nations has proved to have a powerful effect on crops. Nearly 40% of the corn grown in the United States goes to make fuel. The prices of corn on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange rose 73% from June to December 2010. The price of corn in Rwanda rose 19% last year. For many Americans, it may mean a few extra cents for a box of cereal, said Marie Brill, senior policy analyst at ActionAid, an international development group. But that kind of increase puts corn out of the range of impoverished people. Higher prices also mean that groups like the World Food Program can buy less food to feed the world's hungry.
European biofuels developers are buying large tracts of what they call marginal land in Africa with the aim of cultivating biofuel crops, particularly the woody bush known as jatropha. Advocates say that promoting jatropha for biofuels production has little impact on food supplies, but some of that land is used by poor people for subsistence farming or for gathering food like wild nuts. We have to move away from the thinking that producing an energy crop doesn't compete with food, said Mr. Dubois of the Food and Agriculture Organization. It almost inevitably does. And that from the New York Times by Elizabeth Rosenthal. Rioting on empty. There is no shortage of explanations for the food price surge. They range from extreme weather hitting the grain belts of Australia and Russia to growing demand for protein-rich diets in the developing world. Turning corn into ethanol should also shoulder much of the blame. Yet not many American farmers or Midwest members of Congress will admit that pumping ethanol into gas tanks to keep American SUVs on the road might be creating supermarket sticker shock from Toronto to Tunis. In 2010, U.S. farmers produced nearly 5 billion bushels of corn. That's more than all the corn grown in the European Union, Argentina, Mexico, and India combined. Iowa, the epicenter of the corn cornucopia, is overjoyed because the Obama administration has guaranteed its prosperity for decades by raising the cap on the amount of ethanol that can be mixed with gasoline to 15% from 10. That means millions of additional acres of corn will be planted. Since new agricultural land does not appear by magic, one more acre of corn means one less acre of another crop. Land diverted to corn will in turn put upward price pressure on other major crops competing for that acreage, said Tom Elam, president of the consulting firm Farmecon, and Steve Meyer, president of Paragon Economics, in a 2010 report. There's more. As corn transforms itself from food to fuel source, it should come as no surprise that its value is becoming linked to gasoline. As the price of gasoline goes up, so does the price of ethanol. In January, as corn prices were galloping ahead, Peter Brabeck Letmath, chairman of Swiss food giant Nestle, said that turning food into fuel was absolute madness. Food typically consumes as much as 50% of household income in poor countries versus only about 15% in the rich world. We already know that U.S. ethanol is a boondoggle because the industry wouldn't exist without import protection and $7 billion a year in subsidies. We know that ethanol's environmental benefits are at best dubious. Now it also appears to be an inflation catalyst with potentially calamitous consequences in poor countries. Corn-based ethanol isn't just stupid, it's immoral. That by Eric Reguli in the Globe and Mail report on business. Backed up against the issue of ethanol for fuel, Chucky Weiss, two-tone car, which he calls an out-of-body experience.
It got brakes on, the brakes were skidding out of sheet. There go ashtray, there go little seat. Well, in a planetary gearbox, in a future, we go down. Just on the dashboard, got a goofy bar. Everybody talking about my two-tone car. Two-tone car, that's what it is. Going down the street like a planetary gear. Two-tone car, going very far. Everybody talking about my two-tone car. Everybody's talking about my two-tone car. Oh,
Street. Dual carburetors, three-speed Mimic seat. Talking about my two-tone car. Two-tone car, that's what it is. Going like a figure, like a planet, two-tone car, going very far. Everybody's talking about my two-tone car. Everybody talking about my talking about my two-tone car. Everybody's talking about my two-tone car. Everybody's talking about my two-tone car.
And in other crop news, pot laws ruled unconstitutional. Judge gives Ottawa 3 months to fix medical marijuana program where drug is effectively legalized. An Ontario Superior Court judge has ruled that the federal medical marijuana program is unconstitutional, giving the government 3 months to fix the problem before pot is effectively legalized. In an April 11th ruling, Justice Donald Taliano found that doctors across the country have massively boycotted the medical marijuana program and largely refused to sign off on forms giving sick people access to necessary medication. As a result, legitimately sick people cannot access medical marijuana through appropriate means and must resort to illegal actions. Doctors' overwhelming refusal to participate in the medical marijuana program completely undermines the effectiveness of the program, the judge wrote in his ruling. The effect of this blind delegation is that seriously ill people who need marijuana to treat their symptoms are branded criminals simply because they're unable to overcome the barriers to legal access put in place by the legislative scheme. The judge's decision comes in a criminal case involving Matthew Murnaugh, 37, of St. Catharines, who suffers from fibromyalgia, scoliosis, seizures, and depression. Marijuana is the most effective treatment of Murnaugh's pain, but despite years of effort, he has been unable to find a doctor to support his application for a medical marijuana license. Murnaugh resorted to growing his own cannabis and was charged with producing the drug. Taliano found doctors essentially act as gatekeepers to the medical marijuana program, but lack the necessary knowledge to adequately give advice or recommend the drug. He also found that Health Canada has made no real attempt to deal with this lack of knowledge. Lawyer Alan Young said the ruling is significant because it's a Superior Court ruling which has binding effect across the province. The real test, he said, however, will be whether the judgment stands up in the Ontario Court of Appeal. If the government is not successful on appeal, they are going to be caught between a rock and a hard place because they don't have an alternative program in mind. They're in trouble. The medical profession has been wary of the medical marijuana program since it came into effect in August 2001. On May 7, 2001, the Canadian Medical Association wrote, "Physicians must not be expected to act as gatekeepers to this therapy, yet this is precisely the role Health Canada had thrust upon them." And that story by Jennifer Yang, staff reporter for the Toronto Star. Kettling by police at the London G20 found illegal. Ruling has implications for class action lawsuit in Toronto, activists say. The kettling of G20 protesters in London was illegal. A British High Court has ruled in a case with sweeping implications in Toronto. The police may only take such preventive action as a last resort, catering for situations about to descend into violence, the two judges wrote. The test of necessity is met only in truly extreme and exceptional cases. This is groundbreaking, lawyer John Halford, representing claimants Hannah McClure and Joss Moose, told the Toronto Star. "This case is very important and will be used by us in the court," said Murray Klippenstein, who has filed a $45 million class action lawsuit against the Toronto Police Services Board over their actions at the G20 summit in Toronto last June. Office Administrator Sherry Good is representing everyone wrongfully arrested, detained, imprisoned, or held by police on June 26th or June 27th. Good was among about 200 protesters and bystanders boxed in by police for 4 hours on June 27th at Queen Street West and Spadina Avenue. "The British ruling is not binding, but would be persuasive," said Klippenstein. According to the British newspaper The Guardian, thousands of people may now sue Scotland Yard for false imprisonment in relation to the London kettling incident. Also at issue were shield strikes when police jabbed riot shields at a crowd 15 deep to shove them back 30 meters. That, the judges declared, was not necessary or proportionate. The two judges, the president of the Queen's Bench Division, Sir Anthony May, and Justice Nigel Sweeney, stopped short of declaring the kettling itself unlawful. According, keeping violent protesters out might have been necessary, the High Court ruled, but one keeping people in the climate camp in London wasn't. There was no breach of peace, imminent or otherwise. As in Toronto, the McClure Moose case is a class action, said Halford. There were 4,500 people within the kettle. Each of them is equally a victim. The Toronto class action suit will likely reach the certification stage in spring 2012, Klippenstein said. Nearly 10 months later, he said, Sherry Good is still nervous walking in public down the street. And that by Leslie Ciarula Taylor, staff reporter at the Toronto Star. First Nations ignored again, chief laments. Assembly of First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo is troubled that the only Aboriginal issue getting traction in this election seems to be the questionable comments made by a Liberal candidate in Quebec who was ordered to drop out. Atleo remarked that the leaders have made it an unfortunate habit to ignore Aboriginal issues. It just feels people are not aware of the tremendous implications of First Nations remaining at the margins, he told reporters after an address to the Canadian Club in Toronto. No party platform adequately addresses land claims, the affirmation of treaties, or the lack of clean water on reserves, he said. Improving First Nations schools so they are as well-funded and staffed as regular Canadian schools should be everyone's concern, he added. We deploy clean drinking water to Africa and build homes and schools in South America, yet those very same things are needed right here. Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff booted candidate Andre Forbes in the Quebec riding of Manicouagan last week after it was discovered Forbes called natives featherheads. But Forbes has refused to pull out of the race, which means he remains a Liberal on the ballot. That story by Tanya Talaga in the Queen's Park Bureau of the Toronto Star. And now, you knew I was keeping some good news for the last. Nova Scotia expands tracking bracelet program. When Chance the dog came home from the woods near Sydney, Nova Scotia, after missing for 2 days during a snowstorm, search teams redirected their hunt for James DeLory, his 7-year-old autistic owner. They found him shortly after, but a day later, on December 7, 2009, James died in a Halifax hospital. Ross Landry, Nova Scotia's Minister for Emergency Management, evoked James' story after announcing that $273,000 would go towards the project, which is already in effect in Kings County, but will be extended as search and rescue teams across the province are trained to use the equipment. He told the Globe and Mail that James' death caused shock and trauma in the whole community, adding, "We can reduce these incidents or eliminate serious injury." The project, people who sign up, will wear tracking bracelets that emit radio signals unique to each user. When someone enrolled in the program goes missing, search and rescue teams will use antenna to locate them. Natalie Garson, executive director of the Abe Gold Learning and Research Center in Montreal, a nonprofit organization that focuses on autism research and education, would like to see Quebec implement a tracking program. She's also convinced the small size of the bracelets will minimize the chance of stigma associated with autism, a particular issue for seniors. It's not a huge device hanging around your neck. It's the size of a watch now, so it's not intrusive, she said. Barry Thorstenson, president of the National Pensioners and Senior Citizens Federation, supports Nova Scotia's initiative, provided seniors consent to wearing the bracelet. And to round out the show, we have announcements. In East Hamilton, a new community kitchen being formed. The organization is called St. Peter's Harp, and they're especially welcoming newcomers to Canada and to the city. And frankly, I imagine we'll be welcoming the things they know about agriculture and eating and other cultures that we don't know and can pick up from them at the community kitchens. Call them 905-544-0050. That's 905-544-0050. In the old St. Peter's Anglican Church, a block west of Sherman and Main. If you live in Burlington, Brampton, Mississauga, Toronto, Durham, York Region, anywhere else that's using Presto. Disrespect has created a new petition. The cardboard passes now offered on the HSR are going to be discontinued and the computer records of Presto taken instead of your account of your activities. The Presto card company is going to have a minute-by-minute record of your travel on transit, which you may not examine or question. Sign the petition to keep the old passes as a check against Orwellian records of your whereabouts and against the arrogance of IT staff at Presto. Search for cardboard passes on Petition Online Canada and sign it. We'll see that the politicians get it well before the October election. And that's all the news we have this week for Disrespect. But come back next week. You know, there will be more. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.